This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
U.S. Senate, governor's race, and five open congressional seats.
We have to reverse what went down in the big, ugly bill.
I want to raise your wages. I want to make sure that you have access to health care.
I've spent a decade in Congress standing up to bullies and bad actors.
Most of his campaign is about his father's legacy.
Jesse Jackson Jr., the son of the late civil rights icon whose story has become a big theme in the 2nd District race.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Michael Puente, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Candidates are making their final pitches ahead of the primaries. There's some controversy over the mayor's pick to head up the city's Department of Animal Care. Plus, concerns over safety on the CTA could result in loss of federal funding.
The CTA is being ordered to make public transportation safer.
If we were present, there's a chance we could have de-escalated that particular situation.
Any responsible elected leader who has prosecutorial power would say, I'm investigating the murders.
I took an oath that I will follow the law and the Constitution. And that is more important to me than any meritless petition being filed.
There was a lot to get into this week. One of our panelists, freelance journalist Lee John Greco, is here to break down one of the week's top stories. Lee, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again, Michael.
So Lee, you recently wrote a story for Chicago Magazine on what's being called the Battle of O'Hare. What's this all about?
Yeah, so this is pitting two airline giants against each other, the hometown folks, United Airlines, and then the Texas-based American Airlines. And take you back a little bit to the pandemic when flying obviously went down. O'Hare was hit by this because they specialize in international and business travel. So what American did was move around their flights from O'Hare over to the Sun Belt, which was the area where more people were flying. Now, what happened was this left an opening for United, so they increased their number of flights out of O'Hare, which has this use it or lose it policy with gates. So depending on how much the airlines utilize their gates, then every year the city allocates gates to the airlines. Recently, American sued the city because they lost several gates and United gained several gates. American said, hey, you didn't give us enough time to recover. This was premature. And all of this is further complicated by the fact that there's ongoing construction at O'Hare to expand and renovate the airport.
So, but the FAA is also getting involved with this with their own concerns. So how's the FAA playing a part in this?
Yeah. Okay. So now you have all this traffic happening at O'Hare. The airport has been boasting about how it's now the busiest airport in the country, busier than Atlanta, which they've always been looking to kind of jump ahead. But recently, the FAA said, hey, there's too much traffic here. We're worried we're going to have a Newark problem. You guys need to draw down the number of flights happening at O'Hare. So at first, the airlines thought they were going to have to draw that down to 2,800 daily flights, or daily operations, rather, they call it. Now it looks like that might be closer to 2,400 daily operations. And what that's setting off is this big argument between United and and American, where they're blaming each other. United is saying, hey, the only reason we're in this situation is because American dropped a huge tranche of flights last minute so that they could gain an advantage from this use it or lose it policy. Meanwhile, American is saying the only reason we're in this situation is because United is operating so many flights out of O'Hare that nobody else can get in and out of there.
So, Lee, what's this all going to mean, though, for you and I, the travelers?
Yeah, well, you know, before this happened with the FAA, it was good that there was this competition going on between these two airline giants, because competition means that you tend to have lower fares, right? But now it looks like there could be a bit more of a headache if the FAA, you know, does make them draw down operations. Now, I was actually at a meeting with United and other reporters earlier this week, and we asked about how this would affect customers. And, you know, basically they said, hey, we're going to keep the media and customers informed about what's going to go on here so that we can give them enough time to, you know, change their travel plans or rebook their flights. So I think it's going to be something that customers might want to closely watch here.
Well, thanks, Lee. Okay, let's get to the weekly news recap. Joining Lee at the table are Dave McKinney, WBEZ's political editor, and Kerry Shepard, Chicago reporter with Axios. So a coalition of local journalists, lawyers, and elected officials are pushing for a special prosecutor to investigate alleged abuses by immigration agents in Chicago. They say Eileen O'Neill Burke has shirked her responsibility to hold federal immigration officers accountable. Dave, fill us in on this.
Well, of course, this dates back to the Operation Midway Blitz operation last fall that just catapulted Chicago into the forefront of President Trump's federal immigration deportation campaign. There's a law firm in Chicago, Lovey & Lovey, that has filed a petition on behalf of a coalition of more than 200 people and organizations that are demanding an outside prosecutor. That coalition includes some familiar faces, Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia, Congresswoman Delia Ramirez, former U.S. District Chief Judge Ruben Castillo. That last name, Castillo, is the chair of a commission that Governor Pritzker appointed to investigate abuses of the deportation campaign. And what makes this kind of an interesting element facing the state's attorney is that, you know, Minneapolis underwent a very similar kind of experience as Chicago did last fall.
Right.
And there, the district attorney in Hennepin County, which covers Minneapolis, has opened a criminal probe into more than a dozen federal immigration agents. And she, or that office, is capable of doing that.
So a lot of big names behind this. You know, Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke, so far she has not charged any immigration agents so far. So Lee, how is her office reacting to this push?
Yeah. So far, O'Neill Burke says a special prosecutor would make it more difficult to secure convictions. And she also says she's implemented new protocols to investigate alleged crimes.
All right. So we also have the Department of Homeland Security is disputing a Skokie woman's claims that she was detained by immigration authorities for more than 30 hours. So, Lee, help us make sense of all this.
Yeah, lots of twists and turns in this story, Michael. So, Skokie resident Sunny Nakvi says that she was detained at O'Hare for first O'Hare and then moved for 30 hours. Now, DHS is saying that Nakvi was released nearly an hour after she was flagged for screening at O'Hare, and they released photos on social media this Wednesday purporting to show Nakvi was exiting 56 minutes after being detained. Now, some folks here in Chicago, including Cook County Commissioner Kevin Morrison, who's also a friend of Nakvi, They're saying that those photos are doctored, and they're calling this into question, and also pointing to the fact that DHS has lied in the past, especially during their operations in Chicago. We saw that last fall when DHS was misleading when it came to, using pepper spray or retaliating against protesters and journalists.
Credibility issue with DHS for sure.
Exactly.
So we've been hearing, that ICE agents might return to Chicago in the spring. The first day of spring is next Friday. So far we're not hearing of their arrival, but that doesn't mean, the communities where those aggressive immigration raids happened last fall, they're still impacted by this. I recently spent time in some largely Latino neighborhoods on the southeast side in South Chicago with my colleague here at WBZ, Aracela Gomez Aldana. She was in Pilsen and Little Village. And, they say the businesses there and the residents, they're still feeling the fallout from everything that went on. Have you guys been hearing that? Any signs that they might be coming back?
I mean, I would imagine they're still feeling fear and apprehension. Yeah, the warning of March was a little bit tied to the fact that former Commander Gregory Bovino and his crew didn't like the Chicago winter too much, so they skedaddled. So we assumed when it got warmer, just because of all the threats from Kristi Noem and DHS, that they would probably come back around this time. Obviously, a lot has changed. President Trump has fired DHS head Kristi Noem. They have said that, she took some criticism for the way they operated these deportation campaigns, especially in places like Chicago and Minneapolis. And, they say that the Trump administration is saying, we want to do these targeted campaigns, which is, to be clear, what they said from the beginning. I mean, we're talking about, DHS as maybe an unreliable narrator in some of these stories. Right. This is what they always said, but they posted up at places like Home Depot. I mean, this, Michael, right. They posted, that's why you go down to 26th Street in Little Village and it's empty. And this is a thriving commercial strip. So they say that they're going to not maybe do these kind of random sweeps, which, I'm not so sure. And I'm sure like the folks you're talking to don't trust that so much either.
Still a lot of questions, a lot of, anxiety about what could happen in the future. So this is In the Loop. I'm Michael Puente. We're breaking down the biggest stories of the week with a panel of esteemed local journalists, Carrie Shepherd of Axios Chicago, freelance journalist Lee John Greco, and Dave McKinney of WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times. So Carrie, what kind of violence, we're going to change it up to the CTA. What kind of violence have you been seeing on the CTA, and how has the CTA been responding?
Well, so the CTA, you're, of course, alluding to the fact that the CTA owes the Federal Transit Administration, the FTA, a new safety plan by March 19th, which I think would be next week. This comes from the fact that they were told by FTA back in December to submit a safety plan. This is, or they would risk losing funding up to $50 million. So, and this got on the FTA and President Trump's radar and a lot of national news outlets' radar because of this horrific event where this man set this young woman on the Blue Line on fire. This was a terrible story. But there's also been, there's been an unhoused man who's been killed on the CTA. The Sun-Times just reported within the last couple of weeks that actually assaults and aggravated battery are up on the CTA, whereas across the city, they're starting to go down. So the CTA has, preemptively responded ahead of this March 19th deadline,
sure,
and said that they're going to put more cops on. They did already increase it from about 77 to, I think, about 120. They're going to double police officers over time to be on buses and trains, on platforms, security, canine. I don't know. For me, I feel like sometimes I don't know who's security. I don't know who's police when I'm riding. But there's still so much to unravel here. But the fact that they could lose $50 million would put a lot in jeopardy, most notably the fact that we as a city, but especially Southsiders, have been waiting for decades for the extension of the Red Line past 95th. Exactly. And this has been promised since Daley. Geez, Dave, you probably remember, not to call your agent here.
That's right.
It's been in the works forever. And President Biden, right before he left, he said, yes, this is going to happen. We're going to give the CTA this money. And now that is put at risk because some of these safety concerns. The CTA has responded, to be fair, before this. They have put more social service, wraparound services they have provided. But, you know, there's still way fewer people riding the train and the buses since, you know, before the pandemic. So it becomes kind of, you know, there's a little bit different social code now because there are fewer people there.
Sure.
And, you know, when it's below 30 below zero, you know, you would hope that the humane response is to let people ride the train instead of being outside, which brings up issues with, you know, some of the unhoused people.
I do got to ask you this. You know, there is always this added scrutiny when it comes to Chicago and the Trump administration. We know this.
Yes.
But is the scrutiny on the CTA, given their problems with preventing violence on their trains and buses, is it justified?
Sure. I think scrutiny on any major public agency, but especially the third largest public transit service and one that, in addition to just safety issues, we have seen performance issues with it. We've seen ghost buses and we have seen trains that are not on time. And this is how the city moves. We have this privilege for some of us who, you know, get to work from home. We don't have to maybe ride the train, you know, as much, but a lot of people do not have that privilege. They rely on the train and the bus to go to work, to go to school, to go to the doctor. So you have to be efficient. Any world-class city, we know this, across the world, has a world-class transit system. Of course, that's justified.
I also want to note, too, when we talk about the CTA and this difference in social code, back when I wrote a story for the Sun-Times last year looking at the increase in the smoking complaints on the CTA. Those contracted officers that you see, Carrie, you're talking about what's the difference between police and these officers. They're not able to make any arrests. They're not able to issue any tickets. All they can do is inform people of the policy. So it'll be interesting to see if any of the crime that we're seeing on the CTA or also some of these, I guess you want to call lower level, just kind of social code violations are going to go down.
Right, right. Let me ask you real quick, Carrie, about another story you've been working on, you know, kind of an animal lover type story, but there's been controversy over the mayor's pick to head the city's Department of Animal Care and Control. So what's going on over there?
This is Susan Capello. Susan Capello has been the acting director at Chicago Animal Care and Control for about 3 years, 2003. There's a lot of criticism, but to be fair, she also has support from some major shelters such as PAWS across the city, the Anti-Cruelty Society. I went down to Animal Care and Control early this week, and it is a lot like you expect.
Yeah.
The thought is that, you know, Susan Capello's, it's her pushback against some of this criticism that the shelter is unsanitary, that volunteers aren't treated well, is that, look, we have this $8 million budget. New York has a $34 million budget. Houston, which is, you know, the fourth largest city, has a $15 million budget. So, and the other issue is that a lot of these private shelters, they can say, like, we don't want your sick dog because no one's going to adopt it. The city, the municipal shelter, cannot do that. So when I was there, someone left their dog.
You saw that in your reporting?
In the parking lot.
Right.
And they have to take that because an employee told me that this couple came in, and what happens is a lot of people say that they're bringing in strays. They're actually surrendering their pet because there's a lot of other issues. People are having housing trouble. People can't afford to have a pet in their apartment building. And if you can't even house your family, you probably shouldn't be taking care of a pet as well. This couple came in. The employee said, you have to come back at 3 p.m., which is when we do intake, when we accept animals. They have to accept every animal that comes in.
Wow.
Every animal.
That's a lot.
Yeah, Susan Capello told me that Chance the Snapper, the alligator, was there at one point, you know? So this couple was annoyed that they'd have to come back, so they just left the dog. And, you know, it's very upsetting. I was upset. And I said, you know, there's a dog in the parking lot. Yeah. Like, you know, she could run away and run.
Sure.
And they bring her in and, you know, the whole process. But I would say when I was there, it looked like an animal shelter. I mean, yes, they're dogs and cats. They smell a little, but and they are in kennels, but there were volunteers running them outside. And I think that they are up against a lot. She has passed. Susan Capello has gotten through a committee vote, and then she will face a full city council vote next week. Already up to 20 aldermen have voiced their opposition to her, but that leaves 30 people that are either, I don't know, agnostic about it or support her. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see what I've been down there in the past for some other adoption events, and you see a lot of animals. A lot of people willing to take them, but I guess the need is even greater that they can keep up with.
I would say that, Michael, just real quick. Yeah, like people should remember it is an animal shelter. You can adopt an animal there. I mean, we have tons of great shelters in the city, but you can adopt an animal there too. Well,
and you know, it's weird. These these animal shelters, once every blue moon, they'll you know, the intersection between animal shelters and politics happens. And I remember covering a governor's race, I think back in 2010, where there was a bill that went through the legislature that would enable, I believe it was the McLean County Animal Shelter down in Bloomington, to euthanize animals and dogs in particular. And that became an issue that blew up in Bill Brady's face when he was running for governor.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was just like, wow, you'd never expect that. But these animal shelters are crowded.
Yeah.
And there does become an issue. Like, what do you do with all these things?
Well, they have to euthanize them, right, is the issue. And I think you bring up a good point that, I mean, I personally think it's good that some politicians are, there are folks, there are Alderman Ray Lopez is one, who are very supportive of animal welfare. And I think that's important, too.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and 5 focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
In the home stretch for that primary election where the parties will determine who will run in November's general election. You know, Mayor Johnson tried to increase election security by creating something he's calling democracy zones. So, Dave, what's this all about?
Well, I mean, he's trying to invoke the memory of the Reverend Jesse Jackson and naming this proposed ordinance after him. And, you know, one of the key points of it would be to extend this area where federal immigration agents could not conduct civil immigration enforcement within a certain distance of polling places. It looked like it might be a go to get through the city council, but then at the last moment, the mayor put a pause on that, and very likely had to do with the fact that to try to move that on short notice, he needed a supermajority vote in the council, and speculation that maybe the votes weren't there.
You know, there's some pushback in that they're saying, like, how would this be enforced? So you get ICE agents that might get close or may even try to enter. Who stops them?
Well, it is a situation like that. I mean, we saw that, you know, at Broadview, where there were calls for the Illinois State Police or municipal police departments to step in and do something to you know, rebut what the feds were doing there. And you get into this state-federal kind of murky area about who's really in charge. And so I think that is an issue that is facing that ordinance.
And most polling places, you don't have cops posted up anyway, right? And so I'm not sure how they would predict. I guess they would target neighborhoods, predict where law enforcement was most needed. But to Dave's point, I mean, we're kind of running out of time here, so they've only got a few more days. It's a noble effort, and the mayor has made several during Operation Midway Blitz. You know, he was integral in saying, you know, DHS and ICE and CBP cannot go on playgrounds, cannot go in schools, which used to be, you know, these used to be places they would never go pre-Trump, right? Right. There was, say, churches were sanctuaries, for example. So he has made these efforts before. It just, to Dave's point, seems like the enforcement is a little murky right now.
And it would seem if you implement it now, might be cause some confusion.
Of course.
We're so close.
Of course. I was reading that just a few years ago, there were, 24 precincts or something that didn't get their second page of their ballot. So, and this is, election judges are working very hard, but, you know, that's a, kind of a lot to put on a group of volunteers that are spending their day at polling places.
So let's turn to the Senate race. Congressman Krishnamoorthy has proven to be a master at campaign fundraising, but the millions he's raised are coming under scrutiny. So, Lee, you've reported on this. What's going on here?
Yes, I worked on this with Chicago Tribune staffers A.D. Quigg and Dan Petrella, and we dug into who he's fundraising from and also his tactics for fundraising. So I spoke with nearly a dozen former congressional and campaign staffers, and it seems like Krishnamoorthy, over the years, has had a near sole focus on fundraising, possibly even to the detriment of his other duties as congressman. If his campaign staffers who were raising money for him gave him numbers of donors who didn't immediately pick up, he would swear at his staffers. The staffers were pulling 80 to 100 hour weeks, and this was not right before a campaign would happen. This is basically around-the-clock fundraising, which is one of the reasons why he's become the second largest fundraiser, only second to Senator John Ossoff in Georgia, who, of course, has, you know, a state that could be flipped and is really in play here. So one of the groups that we really focused on that's coming under scrutiny are these donors with ties to Hindu nationalism. Now, if you're unfamiliar with that, in India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, he is a member of the BJP, this Hindu nationalist party. He has really cracked down on Muslims in India. And so he is really, the best way to describe him is essentially India's version of Trump. He is sort of the strongman figure there. Raja Krishnamoorthy has drawn a large number of his donors from the Southeast Asian diaspora, and several of these major donors, like Bharat Barai, have had ties to BJP.
So, Carrie, as people look closer to where these campaign funds are coming from, it's a reminder just how important money is when you're running for office.
Yeah, something I don't think we ever forget, sadly. We had an event, Axios had an event at Axios at the Hideout this week with Juliana Stratton, Raja Krishnamoorthy, Robin Kelly, who are considered to be the front runners in the Senate race to replace Senator Durbin, Dick Durbin. And the question we asked, and we asked all the candidates, is what should change about elections? You know, you guys are career politicians, sort of, and they all said, well, campaign finance reform. Except Raja Krishnamoorthy, I believe he said Election Day should be a national holiday, which I thought was interesting, and talked about voter suppression, which, you know, we were talking about in the last break with what Brandon Johnson's doing here. But yeah, I mean, money, I was shocked when I saw Lee and AD and Dan's story about, you know, Krishnamoorthy being the second in the country. I mean,
that's a lot.
Yeah. Ossoff is double what he is, I think, right? Like, Krishnamoorthy's brought in like 30 something million and Ossoff's like 60. So, but still, like, that is, and, you know, reading your story, it's like he was somewhat unapologetic. Like, this is the name of the game, right? Like, this is how you get into office. You need money to run. And the ads this cycle are incessant. Like, it's just like so much. And it's like, you don't always, I try to always read who's funding it on the bottom. And I'm like, I don't know who that pack is and what are they about, you know? So I think that we always are sadly reminded how important money is in these races.
Well, for sure. And it's a situation where, you know, a guy like Krishnamoorthy doesn't have the benefit of being a billionaire,
right?
Like our governor is, for example. But at the same time, you know, we've just seen in history how this kind of fundraising, you have to show great care with it.
Yeah.
You have to have some guardian to make sure that the money you're taking, you know, the people that you're taking money from, that they're clean.
Right.
And that then on the backside of taking this money, that you're not modifying your voting pattern or doing favors for those folks, because that will come back and bite you. And I think the most obvious example of that is what happened to Rod Blagojevich, because Blagojevich was a prolific fundraiser while he was governor. And you know, I can't say that, you know, I can see parallels, but, you know, certainly Raja Krishnamoorthy is, you know, to my knowledge, has never, you know, veered off into the stuff that Blagojevich was doing. But you have to show great care with that much money.
Yeah. And I think it, like, to your point, it is really confusing who's funding these. And especially like in the Senate race, we have all these like accusations of none of them take dark money, right? Dark money. Well, what is dark money? And I had a friend who asked me, like, I don't know who to vote for. Who's more anti-ICE? And I was like, I don't know, I guess, right now.
In the Senate race, actually, can kind of break that down. It is interesting. So Stratton has said we need to abolish ICE. She's kind of come out as the furthest left on that. Krishnamoorthy has said we need to abolish Trump's ICE,
which is what our governor says as well, right? Yeah.
And then Robin Kelly is sort of somewhere in the middle where she has also called for reforms to ICE as well. So it's interesting as you look at the Illinois Senate race, and this is happening in a number of other races across the country, but it's such a hot button issue in Chicago because ICE came here in the fall. Abolish ICE has sort of become the new abolish the police, where it is this buzzword, and you can see Democrats want to embrace it, yet at the same time are afraid perhaps it will come to, you know, bite them later on.
Right.
So I think that's why you see a lot of these politicians doing this careful dance about how they want to get rid of or reform this very troubled agency.
You know, Dave, let's move on to the two seats that open up, because the representatives are running for the Senate, Krishnamoorthy's 8th congressional district and Kelly's 2nd. What's going on in those two races?
Well, I mean, it's what's going on in those races is the same thing going on in pretty much the 4 congressional primaries that are in play right now on the Democratic side across the Chicago area. There's a bitter race until the very end in all of these campaigns. And of course, they're being dominated by spending by super PACs. My colleagues, Chip Mitchell, Mariah Wolfel, and Mawa Iqbal have been following that very closely. And we're out with a piece in today's Sun-Times that added it all up in those various congressional primaries, where it's somewhere up around $27 million that has come from the pro-Israel APAC super PAC, from cryptocurrency, and from artificial intelligence industry super PACs. This money is coming in at a pace that we have never seen before in Illinois. And anybody who turns their television on right now or goes to their Facebook feed, you're seeing, you know, ads left and right that are paid for by entities that have names that you don't recognize.
Right, right. I was just going to say that, Dave. Like, you're not going to see supported by APAC. You're going to see supported by electing Chicago women or something. Yeah. When you dig into the FEC reports, you're like, oh, okay, well, this is actually what this PAC is called. And, you know, that's all legal. That's all fair game for them to do that. And APAC has been a huge one in the congressional race in the 9th that I'm covering on the North Shore and far north side. This has been, you know, this is Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss, State Senator Laura Fine, Kat Abaguzale, and there has been this throwing around of who's actually taking APAC support, who's more anti-APAC. And I do think, especially in that race, that maybe being anti-APAC is not as advantageous as maybe some of those candidates think. Mm-hmm. I do think probably there are still some voters in that district who maybe don't see that as such a turnoff as maybe some of the candidates think it is.
And you still have Skokie in that district as well.
This is what I mean. This is a very, very heavy Jewish older population. Right. And, you know, but also Skokie, extremely diverse. You know, there's the suburbs are becoming even more racially diverse. But, you know, yes, this is largely considered where, you know, a large Jewish population is.
And I guess we should also note that's a progressive district. Jan Schakowsky, who herself was Jewish, was also very progressive as well. So, you know, it just because I guess a district is Jewish does not necessarily mean that they align with APEC.
Oh, of course sure, not. Right. Yeah, no,
well,
no.
Well, and their splits, you know, I mean, the Orthodox Jewish community there, I mean, they might be more aligned with APEC than,
right.
than a more, you know, the liberal side mm-hmm. of the religion. But I mean, you know, APEC is in play in these other districts as well.
Yes.
I mean, in the
7th yes,
Congressional District, City Treasurer Melissa Conyers Irvin is tied to them. Melissa Bean in the 8th District that you mentioned earlier, Mike, is in play. And Donna Miller in the 2nd Congressional mm-hmm. District are all getting, you know, they're getting support from, you know, if not APEC itself, from Shell political action committees that are related to APEC, and then the reporters I mentioned that have been on our team that have been looking into this. I mean, they found, you know, what appears to be coordination with individual donors to APEC who are being kind of steered toward these favored candidates. So it's a big issue in all four of these races, and it's kind of, you know, there's a government watchdog person that we spoke to. She had an interesting perspective on it. Not surprising, of course. This is kind of the tone that they set, but it kind of distorts democracy, she
That's
says,
right.
because we're in a mode where, you know, it kind of drowns out a lot of voices of people who don't have that kind of support and access to money in order to get their messages out.
Democracy. What is that, Dave?
Let me ask
yeah,
you something.
What a quaint idea
what a
democracy
quaint
is.
Idea. Right, right. Provincial.
Well, let me ask you this. When it comes to democracy, something that's could be a trend heading forward, I want to ask this before we get to our next break. An endorsement from Bobby Rush in the 2nd District race made headlines this week. It's a bit hard to understand, but the former congressman says, quote, "I've asked producers to use artificial intelligence, AI, to help me." Let's take a listen.
"I've asked the producer to use artificial intelligence, AI, to help me.
I want to tell you why I believe in Jesse Jackson Jr., why I led the draft to get him into this race."
Ooh, Carrie, so does this feel revolutionary, inspiring, odd? What are your thoughts about AI entering in this race?
I don't remember Bobby Rush sounding like that. I would have to go back to some of the videos of him, obviously.
So he was like a 30-year-old Bobby Rush.
I was going to say when maybe he was still a Black Panther. I don't know. That sounds a little more Obama-ish. But yeah, I mean, I think everybody, I shouldn't say everybody. I mean, we as journalists are often a little wary of AI, especially as it's eroding our industry a bit. And that's another topic, another conversation. I think that, you know, I'm a little confused by this ad when I saw it. I don't know if this is supposed to be Jesse Jackson's, he's being supported by pro AI companies. Maybe Lee and Dave know. I'm not sure what we'd have to hear more of the ad about what the message is of why Bobby Rush said, "Hey, I want AI to, you know, alter my voice."
Well, I mean, it's what's interesting about the ad, too, is that, you know, our great fear about AI is that, you know, there's going to be all this content. And you can see it already. You can see situations. Mm-hmm. I saw something on Facebook about, you know, Abraham. It was an image of Abraham Lincoln giving a speech in front of the Capitol, and he was standing at a podium, and there were microphones on the podium, which didn't exist in the Civil War,
right,
you know.
Right.
But that's the great fear with AI, that we will see these images that look real to us and then believe them. And in this case, I think what sets the ad apart, what makes it memorable, of course, is hearing that, you know, the old and the new Bobby Rush, but he discloses it openly. And that's a good thing. You know, we all can look at that and see, well, this is what he might sound like, but it's a very memorable ad. And, you know, the way you hear the heart-rendering music, you know, being played, and it's supposed to be tugging at your emotions and everything. But it is a memorable ad for Jesse Jackson Jr.
But what is the pro-Jackson message in there? I guess I missed that, right?
Well, like, I think, I mean, Rush is a, you know, kind of a lion in terms of,
yes,
of standing and
right.
in this.
I would have said
South
I worked
side.
With his father. I work, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I would have, that maybe would have gotten me a little bit more to understand why he was supporting.
But I mean, you know, I would think that Rush would appeal to older voters there for sure, because they remember Bobby Rush and That's a voting block that might be important in this race.
For sure.
And Carrie, you asked if Jackson was receiving support from these AI folks, and he is receiving support from pro AI industry PAC, or super PAC rather, leading the future. So there is that element to this as well.
Well, we had weather whiplash this week. Monday felt like summer, then it's followed by plummeting temperatures and hail the size of tennis balls in some places Tuesday night. And, of course, at least two people died and several were injured as tornadoes ripped through northern Illinois and northwest Indiana. So Governor Pritzker spent yesterday afternoon touring Kankakee County, where nearly 500 structures were damaged, and Indiana Governor Mike Braun did the same yesterday in Lake Village in northwest Indiana, where the elderly couple died. So, Pritzker is seeking federal aid for helping some of the damage. Do we think Illinois, because we're deemed a sort of a blue state, think we're going to get any? Who wants to answer that?
I mean, it hasn't looked great in terms of FEMA funding. I mean, that's maybe not totally fair. I mean, each situation warrants, I'm guessing Indiana maybe will as a red state. I'm not so sure. But I think it's a good question. And I think probably something Pritzker will ask for from the president, from FEMA. Yeah.
I think it's certainly going to be difficult, as Pritzker has set Donald Trump in his crosshairs over the last, maybe I should use a different word given.
And vice versa. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Given our political state right now. But he has targeted Trump over the last several years. And of course, seems like he very much wants to be president. But that being said, I think he'll have to take a more diplomatic tact here in order to help his state. Also, there was an interesting story in the Trib yesterday looking at the effect that climate change is going to have on these types of storms. It's obviously going to exacerbate that, but also noted a study that said that these types of severe hailstorms, where we're seeing these ping pong size hail balls, are going to worsen in the Midwest, specifically in the Ohio Valley and Northeast.
They were bigger than that, weren't they?
Well, they were. And I read this crazy thing from somebody way smarter than me that these ice balls that fell, that were 5 inches in diameter whatever, that in order for a cloud to support the weight of those things, there needed to be an updraft, wind going up into the cloud of 120 miles per hour.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Let me ask you this, though. If, let's say, Illinois seeks federal aid and Indiana, they both get it. Well, Indiana gets it, Illinois doesn't. Can it backfire on Trump when it's that contrast right there? It's like, what is the difference? Like, because of politics, one's a red state, one's a blue state. Could it backfire on Trump by not giving some kind of aid to Illinois?
Well, I mean, Illinois is a blue state. Trump here, I mean, he's if he gets 35% to 40% of the vote, I think he cares about doing anything he can to punish the governor.
Right.
That would be his motivation. In terms of backfiring, I think you would see something like this backfiring on Trump if a Category 5 hurricane hit the coastline of Florida or Alabama or a red state. And FEMA didn't show up. That could hurt him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in terms of backfiring, we're gonna see, I think, in the midterms, because this is not about FEMA support, but one thing is immigration. The immigration campaign, the aggressive tactics that the Trump administration has support for that has gone down. It has dipped drastically, and I think that people are seeing this midterm as people are gonna really maybe vote for how they feel on that. But to Dave's point, it doesn't just certainly stop with support, financial support for emergencies. The Trump administration comes after Illinois and other blue states for everything.
That's right. Well, coming up, we have St. Patrick's Day is falling on Tuesday this year, but the parades will be this
Election
weekend.
Election Day, too.
Yeah, well, how about that? We got the greening of the Chicago rivers. But Carrie, you sampled some local products that has like what is these green potato chips?
Green beer flavored potato chips from Local Style, but non-alcoholic, so no hangover. Local Style Chips is a women-owned local company. Laura Gardner, she has these like deep dish pizza, hot dog flavor, spicy jardinera, one of my house's favorite flavors. Very good and very fun and very festive, you know. And there's like sort of a contest when you open these bags of chips. If you get the green chips, you can enter to win a contest. And they do taste a little like a IPA, I would say. A little sour note at first, and then kind of IPA, and, you know, maybe fulfills your beer craving.
But Lee, we're seeing like some local breweries are shutting down. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so this is a trend that's unfortunately happening in Chicago and across the country. Just in one day on February 20th, we had the announcement of Illuminated and Winer breweries closing. And then, of course, about a week ago, Maplewood and Half Acre announced that they are going to merge. All of this comes as basically, since the pandemic, there's been a huge drop in drinking in the United States. I was looking at a Gallup poll yesterday. We have hit a record low for the number of Americans who consume alcohol. 54% of Americans consume alcohol. That is the lowest point since, I believe, like the 1940s. And then on top of that, a lot of these breweries have been hit by tariffs. So the price of aluminum has shot up. And then, of course, the price of all the other ingredients like barley has gone up. You have labor costs that have increased since the beginning of the pandemic. And then, of course, drinking habits besides people just, you know, stopping drinking have changed.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.